Today on the show, we're taking some LSD and following our dreams to become the highest paid podcasters in history.
$100,000 per minute, Leo. Minimum.
The bidding starts at...
Welcome to Gom Jabbar, your guide to the iconic world of Dune. We'll be exploring the themes, philosophies, and characters found in the sandy depths of this vast universe, from Frank Herbert's groundbreaking novels to the adaptations on film and TV. My name's Abu.
My name's Leo.
And Leo, it's about to be a wacky episode today.
Man, I knew we would have to do it eventually.
Yeah.
This is going to be a ride. if you've hit play already, have seen the title of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
We are talking about Jodorowsky's Dune.
Indeed. Leo, you and I both recently watched the documentary.
Right.
Which, full transparency, I have to admit, I had not seen.
I hadn't either. Yeah.
I had heard about it, and we've actually had a listener email us, and that was sort of the inspiration for today's episode. It's something we both sort of knew we'd want to tackle.
Yeah.
But we have to give credit where credit is due.
Yeah.
Armin from Austria, thank you so much for emailing us and suggesting that we do an episode about Jodorowsky's Dune. Here we are, doing it.
Yeah, thanks, Armin. And as always, if you have an idea for something, reach us at gomjabbarpodcast@gmail.com. As always, we would love to hear from you.
Yeah, absolutely. Reach out to us. Send us the things you want us to cover, that you want to learn more about in the Dune universe. Email us just to say hi. We love it all. And we do our best to try and respond. So definitely reach out to us if you're a listener. We love to keep in touch with all of you.
Absolutely. Now, we are going to be talking about this documentary, which is about Jodorowsky's Dune, his adaptation that never happened.
Right.
We're going to be talking about the documentary, and we'll be spoiling the documentary to a degree, obviously. You know, the surprising moments in the documentary, we will talk about them. So...
Mm-hmm.
That is your warning for the documentary spoilers.
Yeah.
Regarding Dune by Frank Herbert, we will be talking about Jodorowsky's ending and thus somewhat spoiling the ending of Dune.
Right.
I recommend if you haven't read Dune, maybe come back to this episode once you have. If you haven't read any of the later novels, don't worry about it. The only thing we're talking about is the ending of the first book. Mostly because of what Jodorowsky did. It's pretty crazy.
I can't wait to talk about it. It's so absurd. It's so just absolutely batshit.
Now, Jodorowsky's Dune, the documentary came out in 2013. Is that right?
Yes.
And it's about a movie that never happened in the 70s. But when I say it never happened, it got like 2 years into pre-production.
Mm-hmm.
You know, script writing and casting and... You know, and we'll talk about some of that. And the documentary does a great job of kind of laying out how close the movie got to happening.
Mm-hmm.
And there is kind of a joy in speculating what could have, what would have been if the movie had happened. And
yeah,
we're going to be focusing on Jodorowsky's vision of what Dune was going to be, his movie was going to be,
mm-hmm.
in his adaptation of the Dune universe, which keep in mind, if you've seen David Lynch's film, this was 10 years before that, which is really kind of baffling to think about.
And it's really interesting to sort of, like you're saying, Leo, speculate about what Jodorowsky would have done or could have done had this movie actually taken off and some of his more bizarre ideas had made it to the screen. That's what we want to focus on today. Today's episode isn't really going to be a movie review podcast, quote unquote.
Yeah.
We're not going to be talking about the documentary itself or critiquing the way the documentary portrayed certain things. Some of that might seep in, of course, during our conversation, but we're really going to be focusing on Jodorowsky himself and what he was trying to do to the Dune universe.
Absolutely.
So before we get into the more specific things we want to talk about with Jodorowsky's vision, for those of you who maybe haven't seen the documentary and are interested, or watched it a while ago and need a bit of a refresher, here is a very quick 60-second synopsis. Jodorowsky's Dune is a 2013 documentary directed by Frank Pavich, and the documentary explores, like we've said, Jodorowsky's failed attempt to adapt Dune to film in the early to mid-70s. Alejandro Jodorowsky himself is a Chilean-French filmmaker author, actor, and mime.
Naturally, yeah.
Uh-huh. It says on his Wikipedia page, take that with a grain of salt, I guess. Like, can't guarantee that that's true. But as we learn more about Jodorowsky, I believe it.
I saw in a couple of articles about him and about this documentary that came out in 2013, I did see that he was trained as a mime.
Okay, I believe it. So Jodorowsky gained sort of cult cinema notoriety in the early 70s for two of his most well-known avant-garde films, one called El Topo and the other called The Holy Mountain.
I have a couple of friends who are very heavily into like art cinema and like movies as art.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of them hold The Holy Mountain as one of the best art movies ever made.
Oh.
And I wanted to put that out there because we might be a little bit harsh this episode.
Yeah.
I think that it's just worth noting, again, we're really talking about his vision for Dune and his adaptation of the text of Dune as we continue talking about this. Just wanted to put that out there.
Totally. No, that's a completely fair disclaimer to say up top here. I haven't seen El Topo or The Holy Mountain.
Yeah, yeah.
I am not the type of film person who watches experimental avant-garde art house films, you know? I spent today watching the Pacific Rim anime that just came out on Netflix. Like, that's my cup of tea. So
high art.
Exactly. Like, Jodorowsky is probably not making the types of films that I would watch or enjoy. So that is a fair disclaimer to say up front that, at least for me personally, I can't speak for you, Leo. I probably would not come across Jodorowsky's movies and watch them of my own volition if Dune was not involved here.
You know, I watch these sorts of movies when I'm in the mood. I got my degree in art, so it is, you know.
And how's that going for you?
Let's not talk about it.
We don't talk about it.
We don't need to talk about that. It's great. It's going great. But I often watch these movies with this sort of sense of this is way above my intellectual pay grade. Like, I just don't get it some of the time. And again, art isn't always meant to be understood.
Completely.
This is sort of a disclaimer for how we're about to dig into the movie.
Yeah, totally. So back to Jodorowsky.
Right.
The guy makes El Topo. He makes The Holy Mountain. He gains some notoriety, especially in sort of like the smaller avant-garde art house film circles. And then in 1974, Jodorowsky sets out to adapt Dune, which at this time is a very popular science fiction novel. This becomes an obsession for him for the next like 2+ years of his life.
Yeah.
And he sort of obsessively works on this, gets a team together, and this is all explained in the documentary. He gets this like crackshot team together to start the pre-production of this movie he wants to make, this like epic, massive project, until this epic, massive project eventually dies when Zero Studios that it's pitched to agree to back it or support it financially, creatively, or in other ways.
Right, right.
And that's the story that this documentary covers. It sort of takes us through this journey of Jodorowsky deciding to create Dune and then the like tremendous work he put into it and then this disappointment of it not getting backed by the big studios in Hollywood.
You know, I want to point out here, according to a couple of interviews I read of Jodorowsky, he hadn't read Dune.
he says that in the documentary. He admits
it. He says it. And his friend's like, what are you going to do next? And he's like, Dune. And then he claims in one documentary, he waited for the bookstores to open at 6 a.m., bought the book, and finished it like 16 hours later.
A 900-page book, to be clear.
To be clear, it's nearly 1,000 pages. And I wonder how much of it he remembers.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. The documentary makes clear there's a sense of disappointment that he wasn't able to bring his dream to fruition. And not 8-9 years after the project falls apart, David Lynch's adaptation comes out in theaters, right? In 1984.
Mm-hmm.
And he was apparently dragged to it by his kids. And they were like, no, you've got to see this. And he didn't want to. And then he apparently, and he says this in the documentary, he says this in all sorts of interviews. He's not shy about this.
This kills me.
He's sitting there going, this is a shitty movie. Thank God. Yo, thank God he fucked this movie up, which rude, first of all.
Oh my God, savage, this guy.
It's brutal. It's like totally uncalled for. And, you know, Abu, you and I watched David Lynch's movie, and we weren't swept off our feet with how great it was.
Yeah, look, I don't disagree with Jodorowsky, to be clear.
It had pugs. It had, you know, Patrick Stewart with kind of a mullet carrying a pug into battle.
Yeah.
Just that scene alone. 8 out of 10 in my book.
Yeah. Look, there's a 30-minute reaction video of me and Leo watching the David Lynch Dune on our YouTube channel, Lore Party Podcast Network. Go watch that. Incredibly fun time watching that together. Yeah. But I will say, it was really interesting that Jodorowsky just outright, in this documentary, laughs. And he's like, I was filled with joy because the movie was shit.
Yeah.
And I was happy that it sucked. And on some level, you can understand that, right? And on some level, you almost have to give him props for just being really brutally honest about that. Like, of course he's going to come at it from a biased perspective. If someone else got to make the movie that you spent 2+ years of your life obsessing and then it sucked, you're going to feel kind of good about that. So he's pretty open about his feelings about that.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Now, the other movie that's being made, of course, is Denis Villeneuve's upcoming film,
right,
which none of us have seen yet.
Right.
And he had some thoughts to share about the Denis Villeneuve adaptation as well after he saw the trailer, which we were all very hyped about.
Right.
He's on the record saying that he wishes Denis the best and he hopes that the Dune movie will be a big success for him, but that he watched the trailer and he thought it looked predictable and that there were no surprises in the trailer.
Yeah, like that there's a lot of money, but nothing more than that that he can see yet.
Yeah, and to me, I read the full quote and it seemed more of a jab towards Hollywood than it did towards Denis Villeneuve or his adaptation.
Yeah, yeah.
It seemed like a jab of like, oh, it's predictable because it just looks like a big money blockbuster that Hollywood churns out year after year, you know, and Jodorowsky being this sort of experimental avant-garde filmmaker, of course, it's going to look like a boring Hollywood production to him.
Yeah.
So I think that was more of a jab against Hollywood than it was against Denis Villeneuve himself. So again, I don't disagree with Jodorowsky's takes here.
You know, I mean, honestly, if you were to show me side-by-side shots of moments of the Dune trailer and Prometheus, could I pick them apart?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, he's not wrong that there is a look of Hollywood and like big-budget movies that this movie sits in, but I've heard this argument often from colleagues as I was learning about art and art history of, as soon as big money's involved, you can't actually make a soul-stirring work of art, which I just think is utterly wrong.
Yeah.
It's like, just because it looks a certain way or is funded a certain way or even has a certain person behind the helm makes it suddenly not art. I just don't agree.
Right.
I don't know. There's a lot of gatekeeping in the world of art, and why you got to poop on people's parades? Just
completely. Yeah. And it's interesting because I think Jodorowsky would actually disagree with you.
Yeah.
You know, he's very much this, like, don't become part of the machine. Like, if Disney approached Jodorowsky to make a Marvel movie, he'd be like, get the fuck out of my face, you know? Like,
yeah.
So that's the kind of, like, capital A art guy he is, or at least that was my impression from watching this documentary.
100%, yeah.
And the documentary is full of, like, interview footage with him and quotes from him, and that was the vibe I was getting, on top of other vibes that we'll get into.
Yeah.
That I was getting from Jodorowsky, but let's talk about his vision, right? That's what we're here to dig into. That's going to be the meat of today's episode.
Right.
The documentary shows tons of concept art and character sketches and this, like, giant, giant book of storyboards. Like, the dude, like, storyboarded out the entire movie.
Yeah.
And it's this incredible, almost ridiculous amount of pre-production that Jodorowsky and this team that he put together did before they took it to Hollywood and it got rejected. And the documentary shows a ton of that. It doesn't show all of it, but we get glimpses of what Jodorowsky wanted to make. And that's what we want to talk about today.
You can also find online, I was kind of delighted to find this, you can find online a full script, basically, that Jodorowsky's team distributed as part of like a crowdfunding campaign for another Jodorowsky film. And we are going to talk about a couple of moments from that script because that is a more comprehensive view of his actual vision of the story. You know,
mm-hmm.
We get in the documentary, we get these glimpses, we get to see character sketches, we get to see. And I think we're in agreement here. That's like the best part of the movie.
Yes.
It's so beautiful, parts of it. It's so gorgeous. And it was interesting. You know, I read the script top to bottom the other night and I'm glad I did. but it also kind of cemented some of my suspicions. But in any case, we do sort of build, if you watch the documentary and you see these kind of fun visions, you do get kind of a general understanding of how his vision differs from the original novel. And I think we can talk about some of these things pretty safely, you know?
Yeah.
Especially considering if you've listened to all of the spoiler-free episodes of Gom Jabbar, some of these points you will recognize as being patently different from Frank's vision of Dune.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you did a very brave thing and read through that entire script, which I didn't do. So, Leo, please take us through some of the highlights. What stood out to you from that script?
Yeah, well, just to start off, we talked about in the timeline of Dune that Terra, planet Earth, was hit by an asteroid, that humanity is not on it anymore, but that it is still around, and it's this sort of preserved park. In Jodorowsky's vision, Earth is utterly gone, and weirdly, humanity is stuck in the galaxy by this magnetic wall, which kind of like rings Truman Show for me. You know, he's on the boat and he gets to the sky wall and he's like, what the hell? Yeah, humanity's stuck in this one part of the galaxy, which for anybody who's read the later Dune books, doesn't really work.
Right.
Also, Duke Leto, famously father of the main character.
Yep.
In this version, was castrated.
Hello.
In an accident that also killed his father. And Abu will be talking about that later.
Yeah, we're going to touch on that.
A couple of characters, for some reason, are just differently named. Piter, that we've always called Piter DeVry University.
Go Bobcats!
Go Bobcats. What, the Groundhogs?
Oh, it was Groundhogs. Shit.
I was like, is their mascot changing? He's called Peter throughout, so I don't know. I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
Also, there was a point that, like, Thufir Hawat, his name just had an extra T throughout all of the publicity materials. Why? I mean, why? Why would you change that?
We're going to be asking that quite a bit this episode as we talk about Jodorowsky's vision.
Just a desperate pleading why. This is my response to so much of this adaptation. Baron Harkonnen, who in the book, he's held up constantly. He's such a certified thick boy that he is constantly held up by suspensors, literally gravity-defying Holtzman suspensors, to help him move his beautiful bulk around wherever he's going. In Jodorowsky's version, they're used a little bit more intermittently. Like, they're used in a dance sequence, which is fun, but that is different. I mean, again, this is, in the book, they're not in any sense, like, intermittent use.
Yeah.
They're kind of an all-the-time thing.
He needs them.
He needs them.
To physically move around.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a requirement.
Now, we get a few, in Jodorowsky's version, we do get a few bloody kind of action battle scenes that happen in the books, but happen off-page. So we don't see them happen, but they happen. And in Jodorowsky's version, we are there in the thick of it, which is kind of surprising. When I think of, like, art films, I don't think constant action.
Yeah.
I don't think fight scenes. But weirdly, his adaptation has a good number of fight scenes.
Yeah. And it's a movie adaptation of a book.
Yeah.
Reading action in a book is not as exciting as seeing action on the screen.
It's true.
So that makes sense. Add in some action scenes that maybe happen off page in the books. That seems like a good change to me.
Yeah. Honestly, I'm not opposed. This is one of the changes that I think works for the movie medium rather well.
Yeah.
Now, a couple of character changes. Duke Leto, who I mentioned is weirdly castrated, is way more like reckless and kind of defaults to violence as a solution more often in Jodorowsky's version than you'll see in Dune. And one of his like masters of war, Gurney Halleck, who's kind of known as this poet warrior, in Jodorowsky's version, Gurney comes up with a strategy of building a human meat shield out of women and their children.
Yikes.
Where you don't want your soldiers to get damaged, so put women holding their children in front.
The Atreides would never.
I don't think I need to stress this. These are the good guys. These are literally the protagonists of Dune. They wouldn't do that.
They would never. Oh my gosh.
There's no universe in which a loyal Atreides would do this. So, I mean, I guess props to Jodorowsky for writing exactly what the Atreides wouldn't do. Mm. I mean, exactly perfectly wrong.
That's a theme we're going to touch on a little later, too.
Yeah, yeah. Another strong choice, we'll call it, was, you know, this story has themes of prescience. Halfway through the movie, you just see the ending of the movie, which is like a really, I mean, I guess it's in line with prescience, but I guess if it works for you, buddy.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, really the last like fifth of the story is very, very different. And we will be talking about the ending of Jodorowsky's Dune. Just know that the last fifth of his vision of Dune is not even remotely.
Not even close
not,
to what
not
actually happens.
Even he threw the dart at the dartboard and it ended up in the bar next door. It's a wild deviation from the roadmap. So anyway, those are sort of the biggest changes. There are some other changes, but there's not a lot that I can say about them without directly comparing to things that happen in the story. So I just know that there's a lot of small differences here and there.
Yeah, and I will say, in regards to the ending, he sort of cripples the possibility of future movies, the way he ends it. We'll get into it. We're about to talk about the ending here. But that, to me, seems on brand for Jodorowsky.
Yeah.
He's not a franchise filmmaker. You know what I mean? Like, he's not making MCU movies. He's not going to be part of the system. Like, one and done. Here's my masterpiece. Drop the mic. I'm out. And he definitely didn't have any intentions of making a Dune 2, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
At least what we can interpret from how he chose to end this movie. But yeah, I mean, a lot of changes in this adaptation. Some you would honestly expect, right, Leo? Like,
right.
Things are going to change when you adapt a novel to the screen. Things have to change. It's a different medium. It's a different way of storytelling.
Totally.
We expect the upcoming Denis Villeneuve adaptation will also change a number of things from the novels to make it more palatable, maybe, to a larger audience, to make it easier to understand or interpret some of the more complex things happening in the novels. Those are going to be changed a bit for the adaptation. But we hope the heart of the message that Frank Herbert is trying to convey in his novels, the heart of the story and the heart of the characters, remains intact. And that's really all you can hope for with an adaptation, is that the soul of the original work is still there.
Totally.
Even if the things that support it have to be changed for the medium.
Yeah.
But with Jodorowsky, some things changed a lot.
Yeah.
And I would argue tarnished a lot of the soul of Dune as well. So I think we should get into some of the more specifics that we've been sort of hinting at. You and me watched that documentary in preparation of this episode, and we each picked three moments from that documentary to sort of dive into more deeply and talk about specifically. So I think the best way to approach this maybe is we bounce back and forth. I do one, you do one.
Sounds good.
And we'll go down our list of our three picks that we want to talk about, the things that like really,
right,
really stood out to us in this documentary.
I definitely was looking at the things you chose, and I think that we are critical at about the same times and complimentary at about the same time. So
yeah.
Let's start off with this first one. You wrote down the character sketches, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I wanted to start off by talking about some of the character sketches that we see in this documentary.
Right.
I will say, despite my complicated feelings about Jodorowsky's adaptation,
sure,
these character sketches, I really, really liked.
Pretty dope.
They were so, so expressive and colorful and unique.
Yeah.
It really gave me JoJo's Bizarre Adventure vibes.
Yeah.
If you're a fan of anime and if you've seen that particular anime,
mm-hmm.
you know exactly the vibes I'm talking about. These like very colorful, striking character designs that are instantly memorable. And I think Jodorowsky's characters, at least their costumes and their designs, would have been instantly memorable.
Totally.
If they followed these sort of sketches and early development outlines and sketches that they showed in this documentary.
Yeah.
Just so, like I was saying, vibrant and colorful and expressive. And what I liked about that is sort of going back to Jodorowsky's critique of Hollywood and big budget filmmaking all looking the same. A lot of modern sci-fi does kind of look the same, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's either this like Blade Runner-esque aesthetic where everything's very drab and dark and neon and gray.
Right.
Everyone's wearing like a big gray coat with a popped collar or whatever. Or it's like the sleek, shiny Star Trek vibes where everything is like holographic and blue and once again, gray. And that's sort of the modern vision of what sci-fi is, right? These characters that they showed have like pinks and purples and yellows and greens, like their clothing, their designs, so expressive. And I think that kind of speaks to 80s science fiction was definitely a little more surreal like that. And modern sci-fi has sort of now trended towards this like grounded brown, gray, drab sort of future. These character sketches just, they were instantly memorable to me and they were kind of astounding. And I was like, wow, I want to see that version of Paul Atreides on screen.
Right, yeah.
That would have been something.
And none of them were excessive.
well, some of them were a bit too much. I will say, some of them.
Yeah.
I don't know what it was about the 70s and 80s, Leo, but men in cod pieces was such a vibe. Men in science fiction. We literally saw Fade Rotha.
Yeah.
In a codpiece in the movie, and the Fade Rotha in Jodorowsky's Dune in like a bright, bejeweled codpiece. And I'm like, why?
Pretty bold. He's the villain. Can you tell? He's dressing for heat. He's dressing for the desert, you know?
It breathes.
It breathes. Nothing breathes like a codpiece.
Only a codpiece and maybe a cape.
You have to have the cape.
Yeah. You're totally right, though, Leo. Like, some of the designs are really, really interesting, and some of them just take it way too far. The Baron is, like, in these, like, very bright jewels, and some of the clothing is, like, very frilly. And, you know, at the end of the day, it was still extremely colorful and memorable. Right. And the fact that I remember that bejeweled codpiece that Fade Rotha is wearing speaks volumes.
So, Gom Jabbar codpiece merch store win.
It's coming soon.
It's coming soon. Yeah.
It's going to have our faces on it.
You're right that a lot of sci-fi is either WALL-E or it's Eva, right?
I love that. Yeah. Yeah.
It's either drab, dirty, dark, or it's sleek, futuristic. And it also, if you look at imagery from El Topo and the Holy Mountain, he does love colors and he uses colors really expressively in some really incredible ways in those films. But when it starts getting in the way of either taking a character as seriously as you absolutely have to for the story to make any sense, or when it's leaning into really problematic tropes that were prominent in the, you know, 70s and 80s, again, just better to leave that behind.
yeah.
Though the casting, can we talk for a second about the people who'd be wearing these cod pieces and lounging in these colorful jewels? Because the illustrations are incredible. You're totally right. And then the people that he managed to get.
Oh, man.
It's baffling.
Baffling.
It's crazy.
And he convinced them.
Yeah.
It's wild. So let me quickly run through some of the main cast that this documentary showed us.
Right.
First and foremost, Paul Atreides is played by Jodorowsky's son.
A little weird.
A
little strange.
And it kind of delves into this like icky territory of he's training his son and trying to raise him to like embody the Kwisatz Haderach and to become this like Paul-like character. He like there's an interview with the son and the son is like, I mean, he's a grown man now, but he's like, he wanted me to just be Paul.
Yeah.
Like he was raising me to just be Paul in this fucking movie.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's not a good way to raise your child.
6 hours a day, 7 days a week for 2 years.
Yeah.
His son was being trained to like fight and stuff.
Yeah. It was very weird. The fact that he even casted his own son was very weird.
Yeah.
And even in the documentary itself, there is a interview with Jodorowsky where he says, like, looking back on it, Dune became this like obsession for me. And it's something that I would have done anything for. Like I would have died to make this movie at the time.
Yeah.
And now I feel a little bit of guilt in how I treated my son when it came to casting him in that movie. So I think Jodorowsky definitely recognizes that he did not treat his son well in his obsession to like try and force him into this casting role as Paul. But that was a choice he made back then. Among some other choices he made, like deciding to approach Mick Jagger to play Fade Rotha, and Mick Jagger agreed.
Yeah, said yes. Also, 10 years prior to Sting playing Fade Rotho. So kind of shocked at how close to the actual, like, David Lynch's adaptation some of these are.
Yeah. Another casting choice that just baffles me, and this is such a wild story, they get into this in the documentary,
yeah,
is he really wanted Salvador Dali to play the Emperor, and he went to such great lengths to convince Dali to do this. And we cracked a joke at the very top of this episode about being the highest paid actors. That's in reference to Dali. Yeah. Dali demanded to be paid $100,000 per hour. He wanted to be the highest paid actor in Hollywood at the time. That's the only way he'd agreed to be in Jodorowsky's Dune.
Yeah. You want me to wear that codpiece? $100,000 an hour. That's my price. Now, what they did then was say, how about we pay you $100,000 per used minute of footage,
mm-hmm.
and then we will build a Salvador Dali robot to be the Emperor in all but like 3.5 minutes of footage. So they'd pay him like $350,000
mm-hmm.
for his 3.5 minutes. And Dali said,
yeah,
I'll do it if I get to keep the robot.
And to be fair, I don't think Dali wanted or cared about the money.
No. Yeah.
He just wanted to put on his resume, I am worth $100,000 per hour. That's how much you got to pay me.
Yeah.
And so, like, Dali agreed to be the Emperor.
Yeah.
Absolutely fucking bad shit.
That's wild.
And the final casting choice that this documentary gets into is the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen.
It's crazy.
And this is also absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
Jodorowsky really wants Orson Welles to play it because Orson Welles has this reputation of being, like, a heavy drinker and a heavy eater. He's, like, a bigger guy, heavy set guy.
Yeah.
And Jodorowsky really wants him to play the Baron.
Yeah.
So he meets him at his favorite restaurant. You know, Jodorowsky makes his pitch and Orson Welles is like, no, I'm not interested. I don't want to do this. But Jodorowsky's like, this is your favorite restaurant, right? I will hire the head chef to be on set and you will eat like you do in this restaurant every day you're on set. Will you agree to be in the movie? And Orson Welles agrees.
I can't believe it. Like, this whole... Again, whatever we say about Jodorowsky, he is a superb storyteller, and some of these sound myth-like. I mean, they sound not real.
Yeah.
But everyone involved in the project seems to be on saying this is how it happened. So, God, I guess he got Orson Welles.
Really crazy stuff. And Jodorowsky comes off as such a charismatic, really ambitious, like, he's got this sphere of, like, you believe him when he says this movie's gonna change the world and I want you to be part of it, and you're kind of, like, absorbed into his sphere of influence.
Yeah,
for a second you're like, yeah, like, this dude's maybe crazy enough to change the world. And then the bubble starts to burst a little bit and you're like, ah, this dude's kind of a megalomaniac, and
right,
his ambitions are maybe a little bigger than the reality. But you can't deny that he worked his charm on people like Salvador Dali and Mick Jagger and Orson Welles, and at the very least got them to agree to be in the movie. Whether or not they would have followed through with it if the movie had actually been made is another story, an answer that we'll never know. But they at least, to his face, agreed to be in this movie for him. Really wild stuff.
It's incredible. As we kind of wrap up this point, tying it back to the art, it is worth mentioning that he had Geiger, this incredible painter who was already kind of had a name for himself in the painting world, who then went on to work on Alien and applied a lot of that same energy to the first Alien movie.
Yeah.
Not to mention, he also had Mobius, right? Is that how you say it? Mobius?
Yeah.
And he's the one who, like, hand storyboarded the entire book. So really, to kind of emphasize and completely agree with what you were saying, the character illustrations, as wild and crazy as some of them were,
mm-hmm.
and the people who are going to embody them, were all brought to life really beautifully by the artists that he also got to buy into this idea of Jodorowsky's Dune.
Yeah.
Really incredible stuff. One of the things that I took away from the documentary, which I really appreciated, was that each planet and each major house had its own aesthetic. And
yeah,
he actually, so first, you know, we were talking about Mick Jagger and Dali and Orson Welles. He also approached and got Pink Floyd
crazy
to agree to make the music for like most of the movie. I mean, they were going to be the soundtrack for this movie. And just immediately, like, great stuff. Then he approached a couple of other musical groups, but he settled on this band Magma, and they would carry out the, quote, warlike rates and rhythms of the Harkonnens.
Mm-hmm.
So literally, the Harkonnens would have their own painter, their own artist, as well as their own band and their own kind of music, so that the scenes with the Harkonnens would feel different. And what a great way to use cinema, and what a great way to use film to highlight those differences. I just think that's a strong choice. And I think a good adaptation of Dune does need to make sure that, you know, the different houses and the different families, they have their own cultures and their own aesthetics and their own sensibilities. And showing that to us, rather than just telling us in some exposition, I think that does need to happen in a good adaptation.
Yeah, I completely agree. I hope the upcoming Denis Villeneuve film does this as well. We need to feel the difference between how the Atreides act and how they conduct business between the Emperor and the Harkonnens and the other families in the Empire that we've discussed, and even the other factions, the Bene Gesserit, the Spacing Guild. It's important for them all to have a differentiated aesthetic, and this was a really interesting way for Jodorowsky to approach it. I actually agree with you. I appreciated this part as well. The fact that he went to such great lengths really does show his dedication to making sure, hey, these are two very, very different clans of people, the Atreides versus the Harkonnens versus the Bene Gesserit, and they all deserve their own sort of treatment.
Yeah.
And yeah, I completely agree with you, Leo. This was one part of Jodorowsky's vision that I appreciated and that I hope translates to, you know, Denis Villeneuve, any other adaptations of Dune.
This is kind of a double-sided sword, though, because while, you know, the other side of this is that in some ways it might have been too extreme, you know, cod pieces notwithstanding. The upper echelon of Dune politics, the great houses, a lot of them are, if not directly related, from very similar stock. So having Harkonnen look like a completely different universe or a different movie could be too much, and I think would work against the fact that though they are different cultures and though they might have different dispositions and they treat people differently and they treat their planets differently, you know, we talked about how Giddy Prime, House of the Harkonnens, is this industrialized, polluted, awful place, whereas Caladan, House of the Atreides, is this luscious, beautiful, well-kept paradise. Well, yeah, such are the values of those houses. And given 10,000 years of living on a planet, the dominant, you know, spacefaring people will have a direct effect on that planet's climate. So that is not outside of the realm of understanding. But having them speak, for instance, different languages would be taking it too far, because that's then breaking some very real rules in Dune, which is that everyone speaks a common language,
right?
Basically.
Yeah, definitely. There is a fine line to walk there. I agree. It's still a single universe and they're all still humanity. But the differences between the houses is still important to, and the planets. We talked about many of the planets in our Planets of Dune episode. All of them should be distinct. And I hope they are visually and aesthetically and musically.
Yeah.
So, Leo, the number two item on my list that I wanted to talk about is the ending.
Yeah.
We've been teasing it all episode. We've brought it up earlier. Let's finally talk about it.
Yeah.
And just to reiterate, this is Jodorowsky's ending to Dune, and it is not the ending to the actual novels.
Yeah.
So we won't actually be spoiling the novel and what actually happens in the books.
Not even close.
This is purely from Jodorowsky's mind.
Right.
Let me try to summarize this in some fashion here. So in Jodorowsky's Dune, at the end, Paul Atreides dies.
Yeah.
And the planet Arrakis undergoes a instant transformation. Imagine this as the final scene of the movie. We see the spice melange becoming agitated and almost coming to life across the planet.
Sure.
The planet starts growing grass and plant life all over. It becomes this like lush green paradise.
Uh-huh.
The question that pops into my mind at this moment is, what the fuck happens to the worms? Who knows? There's no explanation of that. The worms are so critical to the Dune universe. Anyway, again, Jodorowsky's version, not the book version. The melange is agitated. Grass, lush planet. Arrakis is suddenly and instantly transformed into a paradise planet.
Right.
Paul's conscience is absorbed by the planet, and Arrakis becomes sentient, is how Jodorowsky literally describes it.
Yeah.
That's his word. He says Arrakis becomes sentient by absorbing Paul's conscience.
Naturally. Uh-huh.
And the planet decides, with this newfound sentience,
yeah,
to travel across the galaxy,
right,
quoting Jodorowsky here again, quote, illuminating other planets along its path. Don't know what that actually means until it eventually leaves the galaxy.
Yeah, road trip.
And disappears. Roll credits.
Roll credits.
That is the end to Jodorowsky's Dune.
Wow.
Or at least the end that he envisioned.
Right.
And it's a trip. None of this happens in the books.
Yeah.
None of this even makes sense to happen in the books.
Right.
And if we want to give it more thought and credit than I think it deserves, I will say this, like, absolutely batshit crazy ending really disregards a lot of Frank Herbert's message,
yeah,
in the Dune series.
Yeah.
It's astounding to me how off the mark Jodorowsky is with the way he chose to end his adaptation of it. The book itself, if you've read it, you know what Frank's message is. And to have the planet instantly turn into a paradise and to have Paul die and to have the planet just zoom across the galaxy and then disappear, like, none of that makes sense to Frank Herbert's original vision.
Solving all of the problems.
Yeah. It's very, very, very weird. And we would be remiss in not bringing this up because there's a really problematic part of this documentary.
Yeah.
It's not the documentary's fault, and I'm actually glad they kept this hint because it shows us a little bit of the darker side of Jodorowsky, I think.
Right.
But we would be remiss in not bringing this up. When he's talking about the end to his adaptation of Dune, he proudly states that he knows that this is not how the book ends, and he's changing it,
right,
because he wants to. This is the ending that he wants for his movie.
Yeah.
And then he goes on to say, you shouldn't respect the novel. You shouldn't respect the source material. And then he goes on to make this extremely problematic comparison,
yeah,
about how he's treating the source material of Dune to how you would treat your newlywed wife and defile her and sexually assault her. And I'm not saying the word, but I'm sure you can imagine the word he used here, the R word.
Right.
And he makes that really problematic comparison. And he has been criticized a lot, and rightfully so, for making this comparison. It's completely inappropriate. And that's not even a, like, woke 2021 viewpoint. Like, it was inappropriate in 1970 and in 1980. It was inappropriate in the 2013 when this documentary was probably filmed and released. And it's inappropriate now. Like, it's extremely weird. It paints him in a really bad way.
Yeah.
And this was a point in the film where I was just kind of like, okay, I don't know how to feel about this Jodorowsky guy.
You know, I laugh because I'm so incredulous that he, like, I know people like this who have these kind of extreme, I don't care what you think about what I have to say and what I, you know, but it's just so wrong.
Yeah.
And so vile to make that comparison. And also, I mean, when I was watching the documentary at this point, I was pretty on the fence. I was like, this guy's clearly cult of personality.
Mm-hmm.
He's clearly got some strong artistic visions. Any extreme artist is going to have fans and going to have critics, and that's natural.
Totally.
But then he talks about this, and again, you have to wonder, why even then do this book? Like, why even attach yourself to the Dune name?
Yeah.
If that's how you're going to treat the source material.
Yeah.
And it's bad.
Yeah. This was definitely the point where I kind of turned against Jodorowsky in the documentary. And I was like, yeah, I don't want to hear anything else this fuckface has to say. Like, this was bad. This was bad. And we wanted to make sure that we mention it here. It would be extremely disrespectful of us not to bring this up and point out that Jodorowsky says this problematic thing and makes this problematic comparison. And it's right there in the documentary. And I'm glad they kept it, you know? I'm sure that was something that they went back and forth on about, do we cut this? Do we leave this? Is it weird? But I'm glad they kept it. We needed to see that side of Jodorowsky's mind as well.
Yeah.
But going back to how he treated Dune and how he treated this ending, I personally not a fan. Even before I heard this problematic comparison that he makes, even before that point, I was kind of starting to turn against Jodorowsky because I was like, this is such a terrible ending to your adaptation. It would have been a disrespect to Frank Herbert's source material 100%. And to the entire fucking point of Dune. Like, I don't know. Maybe I'm like too attached to Dune at this point, and as a big fan of it, I would feel this like rejection to changing it so fundamentally. But this was one thing, how I mentioned earlier, like you want the soul of the source material to be intact. This was one thing where I was like, Jodorowsky, you're destroying the soul of Dune here by changing the end so fundamentally.
I mean, one of the best things about Dune is its message of, you know, it's got some very deep conservationist messages. And creating this ending where it's like, you know, a single savior solves the world's problems and then the world goes on to solve all of the other planet's problems flies so in the face of the careful, meticulous planning and determination by a people to take care of one's planet. It's baffling. It is exactly wrong. Again, maybe as a work of art, it would be interesting and visually spectacular, and some other story, it would be a very fulfilling ending to some other, you know, artistic declaration. But as an adaptation of Dune, it's just awful.
Yeah, it's just awful.
Bad.
And I mean, Paul dies. This is a note. This is actually your number two pick on your list.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Paul dies in Jodorowsky's Dune. We got to talk about this.
I don't know if y'all know this, but there are more books.
Five more of them.
There's five more books. Kind of tough when you just kill the character. Okay. Let's reiterate. This is not the ending of Dune. We're not going to talk about what the ending of Dune is. It's a great book. You should read it. You should read it.
Highly recommend.
Highly recommend it. If you can't tell, we're a fan. Now, in Jodorowsky's version, Paul is killed by a character who simply would not kill Paul for so many reasons. He dies mid-sentence. He says, you know, has his throat cut. And he goes, one cannot kill me because... And then he falls heavily to the ground dead. And his mother continues, in his voice, obviously, to kill the Kwisatz Haderach. You have to also have killed me. And then every freeman and Atreides begins saying, I am the collective man, he who shows the way, also in Paul's voice.
Oh my God.
And then everyone chants, I am Paul. I am Paul. I am Paul.
In his voice.
In Paul's voice. In his voice. Again, played by Jodorowsky's son. But this is, aside from my love and respect for Dune and the reverence with which I hold Frank's mind and poetry and creative capabilities, completely separate from that, purely as a like popcorn eating moviegoer, this could be a really cool scene.
Like, yeah.
That could be really, what a twist, right? At the end.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
A very I am Spartacus moment.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Cool. Yeah, neat. Coincidentally, almost exactly the opposite of Dune's central themes. Broadly, the series of Dune is a warning against messiahs and a warning against a single person solving all problems, you know? There's this definition. We've used the word Kwisatz Haderach a couple of times. There is a definition of Kwisatz Haderach, which is one who can be many places at once. And if you just told me that and then said, write a script where someone becomes one who can be in many places at once, maybe I could see you getting to this ending. But that disregards the entire, like, 900-something pages of Dune to get to that ending. It's really, it's pretty baffling.
It's something. And you know what? Speaking of disregarding Dune's message about Paul, this segues very nicely into my third and final point on my list here that I wanted to touch on.
Sure.
Which is how Jodorowsky decided Paul was born in his adaptation. Because it is not the way he was born in the original source material.
You don't say.
You mentioned earlier, Leo, that Leto the First, Paul's dad, played by Oscar Isaac in the upcoming film, in Jodorowsky's version, is castrated. Can't have a child.
Harder to have kids that way. Yeah.
Yeah. But look, we're in Jodorowsky's mind here, right? He's going to find a way to make this happen.
He's a problem solver.
The way it goes down in Jodorowsky's Dune is that Leto the First, being castrated, can't have Paul naturally.
Yeah.
He falls madly in love with Jessica. Uh-huh. Okay, so far so good. This tracks.
Sure.
And then she decides to take a drop of Leto the First's blood.
Yeah.
She transmutes it into semen.
Didn't know she could do that, but okay, continue.
Didn't know that was a Bene Gesserit power. And then apparently, according to the storyboards
right.
that the documentary showed us, and Jodorowsky himself describes this to us, we see this drop of semen
yeah.
travel up her vagina
yes.
and impregnate Jessica.
Yeah.
The documentary like animates the storyboards here, and we like really, Jodorowsky goes to great lengths and very excitedly explains this.
He gets so hyped.
He gets so hyped about this. It's extremely creepy. But that is how Jessica is impregnated, blood transmuted to semen, travels up her vagina. We are on that journey with the semen. And that is how Paul is born in Jodorowsky's version. Why would he do this, you may ask?
Yeah, why?
Jodorowsky apparently didn't want Paul to be born of sort of normal, lustful desires,
sure.
you know, birds and the bees. Like,
get rid of them. None of them.
dear listeners, your parents have had this talk with you. Leo and I are not responsible
True.
Of having this yeah. talk with you. You know what we're talking about, or you don't.
we promised not to spoil anything.
So Jodorowsky didn't want Paul to be born of like normal sexual desires.
Right.
He wanted Paul to be born of pure love and apparently Bene Gesserit witchcraft.
Can I quote him here?
Yeah. The direct quote is so great. I'm glad you wrote that down here.
Quote, Paul had been born from a virgin and not of the sperm of his father, but of his blood. Which, if you've watched The Holy Mountain, religion and like the iconography of religion is something that he often works with.
Yeah.
But also, this is just completely against everything Dune's about.
Yes. This makes Paul into like this Jesus figure.
Yeah.
This literal fucking Messiah, which Frank Herbert is like, no. Messiahs
no.
are bad.
They're bad. They're a problem.
They're a problem.
Jodorowsky's like, I hear you. I love your book. Didn't read it.
I get that. I understand what you're saying.
He's Jesus. I fixed your story, bro.
Again, it's astounding to me how off the mark this is. And to your point earlier, it almost makes it seem Jodorowsky didn't read the book or read it so quickly in 16 hours that he missed huge, huge parts of it and completely missed some of the messages here. So I hate this. It should be very clear. I hate this change. Paul's weird birth,
yeah.
Leto the First being castrated. It's all so unnecessary and so just out there and weird and goes literally against what Dune stands for. And it also, like, not to get even more nitpicky, but it also goes against everything we know about the Bene Gesserit breeding program. Like, if the Bene Gesserit can just walk around taking blood samples and turning into semen, like, why the fuck are they? It's just so wrong.
He's solving a problem he made.
Yeah.
He's like, well, how is Leto going to have kids?
Right.
He just has kids. No, but he doesn't have he's been castrated.
Right.
What? Since when? Well, since I made him that way. God, what a weird adaptation.
What a weird adaptation. All right, Leo, my head hurts. Let's wrap this up. What was your third and final point here?
You know, he didn't read the book. He did read the book. Okay, he read the book. And if you read the script, there are a lot of scenes that are almost word for word the book. And those scenes are great. I was reading the script going, wow, this scene's really wonderful. Oh, wait, it's exactly what happened in the book. It struck me, watching the documentary, how many people were like, I'm on board. I'll do it. I'll help you adapt this movie. What is it about? It's about Dune. Never read it.
Yeah.
And some of them were like, still haven't read it. But we're really excited to pour hundreds of hours into this project.
Yeah.
So, okay, there's no secret here. Abu and I, you know, we love Dune, right? We love the books.
I would characterize our feelings about Dune that way. Yeah.
My dad, just as a side note, you know, he illustrated our little icon.
Yeah, our podcast cover art. Yeah.
Yeah. He works as a book cover illustrator. And, you know, if he got a job, you know, illustrate the cover of this book, he would read, for the most part, I can't claim he did this for every single book in his career, but he would read the book. Because for him, as the artist giving you a cover, he would want to make sure that he knows the tone and the symbols and the characters. And that's a sort of attention to craft and an attention to care around a project that I see utterly missing here. Clearly the people he assembled, Jodorowsky assembled, were dedicated. You know, a number of them moved to Paris, set their lives aside. And they moved to Paris but didn't read the fucking book. Are you kidding me? I don't get it. First, it's just a good book.
God.
Do yourself a favor. Read it.
Right. It's a bestseller. Read
it's a classic. And at that time, it was like relevant and popular. Now it's a little bit more niche. I get it. But still, I don't even mean this to like besmirch the individuals, the artists, because very clearly they were all bought into the vision that Jodorowsky had and into Jodorowsky himself.
Yeah.
Very clearly, they said yes because of the man in front of them, and they committed themselves for 2 years, 2+ years, to bringing his vision to life, regardless of the source material, which this doesn't necessarily mean it would be a bad work of art, but when we're talking about its clarity as an adaptation of the story,
yeah,
of course it's going to miss the mark if no one working on it's read it. And Dune, on the surface, is kind of a fun romp through the desert. But when you take the time to dig into it the way that Abu, you and I do every episode, and the way that so many people have done for so many years, the story is so rich and exciting and motivating and challenging and cool. And it warns against things that we still fall prey to in 2021 as a society.
Yeah.
And those messages are utterly lost. If you leave your understanding of Dune at a very surface level, sure, but it's just not going to be a good adaptation, and it's not going to be faithful, as you were saying earlier, Abu, to the spirit of Dune and the soul of Dune.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. It was this cult of personality around Jodorowsky. Your first impression of that guy is like, wow, he's something else. Like, he's so electric.
Yeah.
He is maybe this genius that I don't understand. And I can completely understand how these people would have just blindly followed Jodorowsky, not knowing anything about Dune, into this massive project. I can completely understand how he would have convinced them that this was a life-changing project, that this movie would be the movie of all movies. That, you know, he says this even in the documentary. He's like, I wanted to change the consciousness of the young people of the world with this movie. You know, he's making these like bold claims about this project. It's understandable that like this dude hires you. He probably promises you a lot of money because he thinks this is going to be a massive success or be super well funded. And you're on board. And I think much of this team that Jodorowsky put together shows up in the documentary and shares their experiences. And many of them only have good things to say about working with Jodorowsky, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Again, you have to question the motives of the documentary and the way things were maybe positioned a bit there. But if we take them at face value, what these team members said,
right,
they all were like, he was so electric and he pushed you to be a better version of yourself. And he let us experiment with our art and try new things. And he had this grand vision and we could really see ourselves following him. And
right,
it speaks volumes that they followed him and they did not follow Frank Herbert's vision.
Yeah.
With the actual novel itself. So I completely agree. Like we've sort of talked it to death at this point, but Jodorowsky, in my opinion, and I think I speak for you as well here, we think he completely missed the mark of Dune and getting the message right on it and really kind of went ham with his own vision. So that kind of leads us to our wrap-up question. Let's end this episode, as we always do with our episodes, with a little question for the two of us.
Yeah.
And the obvious question here, after watching the documentary, after having talked about it extensively now.
Right.
Leo, in an alternate reality.
Right.
Let's imagine Jodorowsky got to make this movie. This movie that is anywhere from 3 hours long to 12 hours long, like he claimed. Do you think this film would have been a commercial and critical success had it been made?
No. No. I mean, to be clear, Jodorowsky wasn't looking to make a commercial success. In fact, it really seems like he kind of sneers at the idea of commercial success.
Yeah.
Money, as he puts it, is shit. weird that he didn't get enough of it to make the movie.
Mm.
You know, strange the way that works. But no, I mean, he wanted it to be clear. He took it to Hollywood and said, it's going to be 12 to 16 hours long.
Yeah.
And they were like, no, it's so long. No one's going to buy a movie ticket. It's 1971. No sci-fi movie has been successful yet. No one's going to buy a 12-hour movie ticket. And he was like, well, I guess you don't like art then. It's like, my guy, no, I just don't think. He recently on record has said, well, you know, look at The Hobbit. They made three Hobbit movies. And it's like, yeah, they made three separate Hobbit movies that were separate movies and told one overall story, which you were actively fighting, first of all, with your script, killing the main character at the end and creating a road tripping planet. But also, I mean, maybe critics would have liked it, right? Like,
yeah.
Maybe art reviewers would go, this is amazing. This is incredible. But the average viewer, you know, in the same way that if you look up like the meta scores of his actual films that he did do, none of them are blow away successes. I'll just say this. Keep in mind, this movie included a torture scene that involves removing the limbs of someone one at a time as they're like screaming and suffering. And it's a character we all like. A 14-year-old wife being killed. A mother-son kiss added to a climactic moment, which...
Not in the book.
Not in the book. Not in the book. Hashtag not in the book. And mothers using their children as meat shields. But, like, for the good guys.
For the good guys, as we've discussed. Like, not in the book. None of this is in the book!
I kind of hate this movie.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even made. So...
I am with you.
If the question is, like, if it were made, would you like it suddenly... I have a hard time looking at the script, again, having read it top to bottom. I have a hard time looking at it and going, yeah, that would be good. No, I don't think so. What about you?
I am completely with you. I also find myself kind of viscerally hating this movie that never actually got made.
Right.
After watching this documentary and learning like what could have been and what Jodorowsky wanted it to be. I hate it. And to answer the question here, would it have been a commercial and critical success? No.
Right.
Just no.
Yeah.
Look, the guy made these like trippy avant-garde films and he never really found like massive commercial success or massive worldwide success, right?
Right.
Would this film have been maybe bold and quirky and dramatic and potentially a cult classic? Yeah, I think so. I think I can say that it would do that much at least.
Yeah,
we talked about the character designs earlier, how vibrant and bright and unique they were, and some of the choices in the script and some of the choices that Jodorowsky wanted to make with his adaptation. Definitely bold, definitely quirky.
Right.
For the best, maybe not, but it definitely would have been a very unique film.
Right.
I don't think there's any arguing that. But would it have been a good adaptation of Dune? I think our stance on this is very clear. No. The things we've talked about completely and utterly destroy what Dune stood for,
right.
The changes he wanted to make with the ending, with Paul, with Leto, with the choices around the Atreides. It was just anti-Dune in so many ways.
Right.
And it just would not have been a good adaptation. It would not have represented Frank's original work.
Yeah.
And that being said, I think it would have flopped, ironically enough, in the same way that David Lynch's adaptation flopped for not being a good adaptation of Dune.
Yeah.
Like David Lynch and the creative team behind that movie made some decisions, maybe not as bold and outlandish as Jodorowsky did, but they still made some really dramatic changes to their adaptation. And in my opinion,
is the milking cat.
The milking cat is one example. The blood seeping out of Paul's eyes and him talking to the worms is another example. Like so many choices were made in that movie also in a different direction and it flopped.
Yeah.
And I think Jodorowsky's movie would have flopped for the same reasons.
Right.
And if the movie had been made, I think it would have mostly been remembered as like a bad adaptation that diehard Dune fans like joked about or hated on.
Yeah.
And I think really the only people that would even know about it would be like those snobby film people that just like love talking about movies that no one's ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would have been Jodorowsky's legacy, I think, with Dune, in at least. There's a point in this documentary where someone at some point says, Jodorowsky's Dune could have been the Star Wars before Star Wars, because remember, this is the early 70s when he's developing this.
Yeah.
And if the adaptation had been made, Dune could have come out before Star Wars did.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that claim for one second. Like,
no.
This would not have been Star Wars before Star Wars. Like, are you kidding me? What an absolutely wild claim. The documentary, I know we're not like critiquing the documentary itself, but at the end, it goes on to make such like wild fucking claims. Like, Jodorowsky's Dune has gone on to influence so many sci-fi movies. Like, Prometheus came up earlier, we talked about. They make these comparisons to how the way Jodorowsky drew the sword fights in his adaptation in the...
Did you know he invented sword fighting? It's true. True fact.
And the Star Wars Jedi sword fight looks exactly like Jodorowsky wanted it.
Like, it looks like sword fighting.
At that point, I had already like soured on Jodorowsky. At that point, near the end of the documentary, I was like, fuck this guy. Fuck his adaptation of Dune. And fuck this claim that like he created so much of like iconic sci-fi. Like,
though, you know, in their defense, it is true that Jodorowsky assembled this team of people and 40% of them went on to work on Alien together because of knowing each other from him. So,
yeah,
I get that. You know, I don't want to take that from them because it is true that he brought together some incredibly talented people.
He certainly had an eye for talent. Yeah.
Yeah. And they had like this 2-year time to like incubate some very interesting ideas, some of which he also went on to utilize in his like graphic novels. But yeah, no, they talk about Hollywood executives looking at this phone book thick pre-production book and lifting ideas directly from that for their Terminator.
I forgot Terminator. Yeah.
And the Star Wars sword fighting, which is just sword fighting. It's like,
there are some absurd claims made in this documentary. But all of that is to say, no, I don't think it would have been a success.
Yeah.
It would not have changed the consciousness of young people around the world like Jodorowsky wanted. And in fact, if I may make a bold claim,
sure,
I think it would have actually, if the movie had gotten made and had a big budget and totally flopped and been panned by critics, I think it would have actually scared Hollywood from ever trying to adapt Dune again. And we may never be getting a modern adaptation from Denis Villeneuve, you know?
It's possible. It's really possible.
Maybe it would have scared Hollywood being like, we can't touch this IP. It's been tainted.
Right.
By Jodorowsky's bejeweled cod pieces, you know, like
they have to be there. I mean, it's practical desert wear. Okay.
Yeah. This is look,
utility.
It's hot in the desert. Okay.
It's hot. It's really hot. It's dry. It's hot.
Absolutely bonkers. But yeah, I certainly don't regret watching Jodorowsky's Dune, the documentary.
Right.
I am certainly glad I am aware that this potential thing could have happened, but I am grateful it never did. And I think the entire world dodged a bullet. And I think many Dune fans who love the source material as much as we do, who are so close to the Dune novels and the stories and characters and the world and the messages that the novels contain, this would have been a betrayal of the thing they love. And I'm glad it never happened.
I'll say, you know, if you want to see some cool art, I would recommend read Dune. Read the book. Come on.
It's a good
read
book. It's a bestseller.
It's a bestseller. You don't have to move to Paris. You can just read it. You're allowed to just read it. It's a great book. It's a bestseller. Once you've read it, once you know what it's about, and once you've seen the twists and turns and you see how Frank Herbert handled it, feel free to watch Jodorowsky's Dune, the documentary, because I did find, as a Dune fan, I was like, oh, it's so fun to see characters in this way. Like, there was, throughout the incredulity and throughout the kind of building frustration at this guy's admission of not really having any respect for the book, I would say it is certainly a spectacle. And I think, again, I'm not really equipped to assess a documentary, but I enjoyed the documentary. I thought the documentary was very well put together. And as a product examining this weird could have been, it was enjoyable.
Yeah.
But if you haven't read Dune or if you haven't seen Dune, I would worry about this setting any kind of expectations or leaving a taste in your mouth
right.
That potentially could get in the way. So I would save it for after.
Unlike the team that attempted to create Jodorowsky's Dune, read the source material first.
Yeah, please.
And then watch the documentary.
It's a good book.
That's our recommendation to you.
It's a bestseller.
It's a bestseller.
Well, friends, there is no real ending. It's just the place where you stop the recording. But this podcast is always one step beyond logic, so help spread the word of Muad'Dib and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And be sure to check out the other shows on the Lord Party Podcast Network on LordParty.com. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at lore_party. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, he who controls the podcast controls the universe. We'll see you on the golden path.